This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ashley Ford, is the author of the new best-selling memoir, Somebody's Daughter, about growing up black and poor in Indiana. Her father was imprisoned in 1988 when she was only 1 year old. By the time he got out, she was around 30. She didn't know what crime he was convicted of until she was in her teens. His crime was rape. And it was especially upsetting to hear that because she had been raped by a boy from her school, and it left her traumatized. The book is also about her relationship with her mother, who could be charming or brutal, her relationship with her grandmother, who was very religious and warned about the devil, and her relationship with her own body, having gone through early puberty starting at age 9 and thinking her body was the cause of her suffering. Ford has written for many publications and was named in Forbes 30 Under 30 in Media and in Variety's New Power of New York. Ashley Ford, welcome to Fresh Air. I think your memoir is so good.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. It's truly a pleasure to be here.
So you were about 1 year old when your father was sent to prison, so you really have no direct memory of him at home outside prison. How did your mother and your grandmother describe him?
When they spoke about him, they usually described him as funny or a dreamer, a scaredy cat sometimes. My dad has a pretty notorious fear of bugs or anything that flies, birds, bees, hummingbirds. He flips out, like he's scared of them, and always has been. And there were things about me that they thought reminded them of him. So when they talked about my dad, it was usually like, you know, you daydream all the time, just like your dad, or, you know, you have really good timing, or, you know, Ashley can tell a good joke, you know, oh, she must get that from her dad. Even though I think my sense of humor much more so mirrors my mother's.
Did it make you feel good when people said, oh, you must have gotten that from your dad?
It did, because, you know, without his presence, my connection to him didn't feel very clear. So when someone would say, you look like your dad, or, you know, you dream like your dad, or, you know, you don't like air conditioning like your dad. Those things made me feel like, oh, I really have a dad out there. I have someone I'm really connected to. And even though he's not here, our connection is still evident. People can see him in me. And that made me feel special. It made me feel like I was not necessarily in the situation that I was actually in.
Your mother and grandmother didn't tell you why he was in prison, and you didn't ask until you were older. What prevented you from asking? What was holding you back?
When I was very young and I asked my mom, you know, well, why? Her reaction to that was so big and so sad that it became very clear to me as a kid that that's just not a question I got to ask. It was a question that caused a reaction in my mom that, you know, worried me and scared me. And then, you know, my brother, he asked more often than I did, but he would get the same response from my mother or my grandmother, which was that big emotional outsized response. Or when we got a little older and he would ask, it would become, you know, my mom would say, I shouldn't have to tell you that. He should have to tell you that. And so we were just trying to figure out what had happened between the two of us. And that wasn't really working out because, you know, we were 8 and 9.
What were some of your guesses? Did you think, oh, maybe he murdered somebody?
I did. I absolutely did. That was my number one guess, was that was what had happened. No idea who, no idea how, obviously, but I just assumed because of how long he was away, how long he was expected to be away. You know, no one really talked about, except for my dad saying, you know, one day I'll get out and I'll be there. No one else ever talked about my dad getting out.
How did you learn why your father was in prison?
I had gotten into an argument with my mother before my grandmother and I went to the mall together, which we did all the time, catch the bus to the mall and just walk around. And my grandmother was really curious about the argument, and I didn't want to talk to her about it because my mom didn't like me to talk to my grandma about the arguments that we had. So I was just trying to shut it down. And my grandma, very uncharacteristically, told me I needed to be nicer to my mom and that I needed to be more compassionate with her, like kinder to her, and that she had been through a lot. And I was just like, okay, you know, very, why is she saying this right now? And then she said, you don't know why your dad is in prison. Do you want to know why your dad is in prison? And I said, yes, I do want to know. Even knowing that, like, I was terrified to know. I was terrified to have anything confirmed and have this not be a question anymore. I still said I wanted to know. And she told me, she said, your dad is in prison because he raped two women. And I just froze. I just numbed out.
How did that compare to murder in your mind? Because you were afraid that the worst would be murder, but maybe there'd be a reason to explain why he murdered somebody.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the ability to rationalize as a child is unmatched. And I was trying to find so many rationalizations for why he may have taken someone's life by accident or to protect someone, or, you know, like there were these reasons why it might not have been his intention to harm. With rape, there's no mistake about the intention to harm. You intended to harm someone. And you intended to harm someone in a way that I understand intimately.
Right, because you were raped.
Yeah, about 6 months before I found out that my dad was in prison for rape, I had been raped.
So it must have been like so personal to you because you were the victim of the kind of crime that he had committed. What was it like to try to process that?
I mean, it was terrible. It was terrible to try to process it. I knew that violation. I knew it on my body and in my body. And I knew how it altered the experience of life, of existence for a person. And the idea that this person, this man, this dad had written me these letters all these years about how I was his favorite girl and I was brilliant and I was the most beautiful girl in the world. And he could not wait to see me. He could not wait to hug me. You know, I didn't have adults in my life who were particularly ever excited to see me or be around me. Nobody missed me except for him. And he was now the person who had done the same thing that had happened to me. And how do I make that fit together? How can he be both of those people?
Did you feel like you could ask him that and that you could talk to him about what he had done and if he had changed?
Not initially. Initially, I really didn't want to talk about it. And I did not ask him about it or to explain anything to me or to tell me anything until I was in my early 20s and I wrote him a letter essentially saying that, like, I have to know, because I was still dealing so much with what had happened to me and with my assault that I just wanted to know. Like, I was never going to talk to the person who assaulted me. I was never going to ask him why. I never wanted to see him again, you know? But my dad, I wanted to ask why. I wanted to say, why did you do this? Like, why? And he answered me.
Can I ask you what he told you?
When he responded to my letter, he told me that he had been a young, insecure, deeply afraid man. And he made a choice, an inhumane choice, because he was not thinking of some other people as human. He was so wrapped up in his own pain and in his own fear about his life and his ability and capability that he took it out on two people who didn't deserve it, who had their own lives and their own dreams. And he became a monster so that he didn't have to become a man.
Did you feel that if you had empathy for your father, who was convicted of raping two women, mm-hmm. and apparently does not deny that he did that?
No.
Do you feel like if you have empathy for him, that it means you have to have empathy for the boy who raped you?
The thing is, honestly, that I oddly already do. Not in the way that, like I said, I would ever want to know or speak to him again. You know, that is a boundary firmly in place for a reason. But I understand in a certain capacity that his life went on and that this is a thing that happened, and it is terrible and it is tragic. And I do wish there had been some accountability for what happened to me. But at the same time, there is very little that looks like accountability. There is very little that could happen that would make me feel like, yeah, I finally feel like I got justice. That's not going to happen by thinking of him as inhuman. That's not going to happen by forgetting the fact that diminishing his humanity, you know, thinking of him as less human, separates me from my humanity in a certain way. And I'm in love with my humanity. I love being a human. I really do. The range of emotions is terrifying and beautiful. The range of actions are terrifying and beautiful that a human can experience. And some of my experiences suck really, really bad. A lot of them are fantastic.
The memoir is also about growing up poor and Black in Indiana. You were around 30 when your father got out of prison. You had 2 weeks' notice that he was coming out. And, you know, you say something really interesting in the book, that when your father was in prison, that you felt like you knew him and that he knew you. And this might have been before you found out why he was in prison, before you knew that he was convicted of rape. But that you'd spent your lives mentally constructing versions of one another that you couldn't physically confirm or deny the existence of because you saw each other so infrequently. So can you tell me a little bit about the image of your father that you had constructed and the image that he had constructed of you?
My image of my dad that I constructed early in life was definitely one of a kind of savior. You know, I had this feeling or this thought that, like, everything that was wrong in our lives would have been better if he had been there, if he had been with us, and specifically with me. I grew up watching a lot of Westerns with my grandma, just all the time we watched Westerns and I loved it. But when I would dream of my dad, he usually showed up wherever I was wearing a cowboy hat and on a horse. I used to have these dreams and daydreams that I would be at recess at school one day and that everybody would look in some direction of the playground and all of a sudden my dad would be literally riding up on a horse with a cowboy hat and he would pick me up and put me on the back of the horse and we would go home and my whole family would be there and it would be this big reunion. I used to play that out in my head over and over and over again and found it deeply, deeply comforting. As I got older, you know, and reality started to buck up against that imagining of my dad, the first thing I realized that changed was that I never dreamed about him on a horse again, ever. That dream just stopped. It had been a recurring dream for most of my life, and then it just went away. And that's when I started having to construct my idea of my dad as a human being, not an avatar, but as a person.
Do you feel like a similar thing happened in his mind and thinking about you, that when he wrote you letters, like you were always like the most beautiful, the smartest, the most talented, the best daughter imaginable, but he didn't really know you as an individual human being with your own personality and your own needs and desires. So I wonder what it was like for him to encounter the reality of a specific human being who was his daughter.
I mean, it was really, I suspect, pretty jarring for him, because while I am the best and the most beautiful and the most brilliant, but while I am, you know, I think a pretty awesome person, I am not necessarily all of the things that my dad assumed I would be. Pretty soon after my dad got out of prison, I'd gone to visit him again and decided that I should tell him because I didn't want him to find out in any other way that I had been sexually assaulted. So I sat down with him and I said, I really want to tell you something that's very important to me that you hear it from me. And I said, I was sexually assaulted when I was 13. I was raped. And he looked down at the table where his hands were folded. And he closed his eyes for a couple seconds. And then he looked at me and he said, I'm so sorry. That is the one thing that I just wished and wished and wished would never happen to you and you would never have to experience. And then we just talked about it. And it helped. It helped me to talk to him about it, to hear about his mistakes and how he felt about his mistakes. It reminded me, you know, because my dad asserted over and over and over, you know, about his crimes, that he made a choice, that it had been his choice, and that he had taken away somebody else's choice. And talking to my dad, I realized like, oh yeah, I didn't make this choice. Somebody took my choice. This is not my fault. This is not my shame. It's not my burden. Somebody else took my choice, and now it is their burden.
What's your relationship with your father like now?
My relationship with my dad is good. He's really good with my boundaries. You know, he would call me and talk to me every day if I let him, but you know, I need a little more space than that, really, with everybody. I don't talk to anybody every day. But, you know, I've needed some time and some space to, you know, reach out when it feels good and right to me. And he makes room for that and makes room for me. And I do believe that he wishes he saw me a lot more often. And maybe someday we'll get there. But right now we're getting to know each other. And I really, really like him. And he likes me too. So it's just a budding relationship.
Ashley Ford, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for your book and thank you for this interview.
Thank you so much for your time, Terry Gross. It has really, truly meant the world to me to be able to do this today. Thank you.
Ashley Ford's new memoir is called Somebody's Daughter. A concert performance by singer Sarah Vaughan from 1969 has been newly released. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Vaughan resisted stylistic labels that might limit her options, and on the most ambitious of these performances, jazz, pop, and classical sensibilities commingle. Here's his review.
And there's wine just ready for tasting. Cadillacs, shiny and new, gotta move. Time is a-wasting, got a lot of living to do. There's music to play, places to go, people to see. Everything for you and me lies above. If only you show it and it's all waiting for you, you're alive. Come on and show it, got a lot of living to do.
Sarah Vaughan from Live at the Berlin Philharmonie 1969 on two CDs. Two 40-minute sets from the label The Lost Sessions. Vaughan was then between record contracts and the commercial pressures that go with them. Like other musicians schooled in bebop, Vaughan liked fast and very slow tempos, and here she really stretches out on the slow tunes. She was a virtuoso of vibrato, varying its speed or width or intensifying that shake the longer she holds a note or withholding it altogether for a plaintive effect.
Then you and I came wandering by and lost in a sigh.
One of Sarah Vaughan's signature songs, Tenderly. Most adult jazz and pop singers favor the classic American songbook, but Vaughan was no snob about 60s music if it was sophisticated enough. In Berlin in 1969, she sings a Paul McCartney ballad, two tunes by pop songwriter Jimmy Webb, and Burt Bacharach and Hal David's Alfie, taking great liberties with that one.
Believe in love.
Sarah Vaughan had a voice suitable for high opera. Her rich, full contralto could scoop down into the baritone range and ascend to the heights. She combined an operatic sense of drama and vocal color and control with an improviser's risk-taking, boldly remaking written melodies. That could result in some strikingly daring music, like this sequence from the 1947 tune Time After Time.
See.
that gets so abstract, melody and lyrics fall away. It's about pure musicality, not the song. There is a perfunctory air about some up-tempo pieces on Sarah Vaughan's 1969 Berlin concerts. She races through a few songs in more ways than one, wrapping them up in 2 minutes. Vaughan does show off her playful side and attention to a lyric on the Trolley Song, a meet cute number from the Judy Garland musical Meet Me in St. Louis. There, her trio do a little of what Hollywood calls Mickey Mousing, where the music closely tracks the story's action.
Chugga, chugga, chugga went the motor. Bump, bump, bump went the brakes. Thump, thump, thump went my heartstrings. When he smiled, I could feel the car shake. He tipped his hat, he took a seat. He said he hoped he hadn't stepped upon my feet. He asked my name, I held my breath. Couldn't speak because he scared me half to death. Buzz went the buzzer. Flop, flop, flop went the wheels. Stop, stop, stop went my heartstrings. They started to go and I started to know how it feels when the universe reels.
Sarah Vaughan's accompanists here are little known in jazz. Pianist John Veith, bassist Gus Mancuso, and drummer Ed Pucci. At least a couple of them worked in Las Vegas for a while. The trio is well-drilled and crisp, but stays in the background. It's not like anybody came to hear the band. Sarah Vaughan had one of the magnificent voices of the 20th century, and she put it through extraordinary paces. Then she might turn around and swing a show tune with a light touch. She could do both and everything in between.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you with the glow of your being. Outshines every star, you'll feel part of. On that clear day, you can see forever and ever more.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed Sarah Vaughan live at the Berlin Philharmonie, 1969. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. I'll let him introduce it.
Most of us take commercial plane flights from time to time, and we've come to accept the annoyances of air travel: tight seats, flight delays, turbulence. Our guest, writer T.J. Newman, has written a thriller about a flight from Los Angeles to JFK Airport, where the problems are far more serious. The pilot learned shortly after taking off that a terrorist has taken his wife and children captive in their home, and the pilot has a choice. He must crash the airplane when instructed, or his family will die. The pilot enlists the help of a veteran flight attendant to try and foil the plot, and the action is tense and fast-moving. It's the first novel by Newman, who spent 10 years as a flight attendant, at times working on the story in quiet moments on red-eye flights. She studied musical theater at Illinois Wesleyan University and pursued that as a career in New York before taking to the skies. Universal has already purchased the film rights to her book called Falling. T.J. Newman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to speak with you.
So, did the idea for this story have a starting point in your experience as an attendant?
It did. And the starting point, fittingly, came to me when I was at work, working a flight. It was red eye. It was from Los Angeles to New York, the flight that is also the flight in the story. And I'm standing at the front of the cabin and I'm looking out at the passengers who are all asleep. Like I said, it's a red eye. Cabin's dark, it's cold, it's quiet. And I have this thought that their lives, my life, my crewmates' lives were all in the hands of the pilots. And it was the first time that I thought with that much power and responsibility, how vulnerable does that make a commercial pilot? And I couldn't shake the thought. And several days later, I was working a different trip with a different set of pilots. And one day I just threw out to the captain that I was with, hey, what would you do if your family was kidnapped and you were told that if you didn't crash the plane, they would be killed? What would you do? And the look on his face terrified me, because I knew he didn't have an answer. And I knew I had the makings of my first book.
You open the book with this pilot, whose name is Bill Hoffman, having a nightmare about an airborne emergency where there's an explosion on the plane and he's in the back. And, you know, he knows it's his job to get up there and get the plane under control and guide it to safety. And he wakes up and things are going very, very badly. Do you know if pilots have these nightmares, or did you?
They do. That's actually a very common thing. Pilots have reoccurring nightmares. And I actually asked a lot of pilots what kind of nightmares they have. And it was really incredible to see sort of the common threads that went through these dreams and sort of the themes that went through these dreams also. And one of the themes that really seemed to stand out was that lack of control, that inability to do what they needed to do to handle a situation. And so that kind of shaped that opening sequence and what Bill's, you know, biggest fears were.
Did you have nightmares yourself?
I did, but most of them were more flight attendants also have this running joke that we'll be dead asleep and all of a sudden wake up and go, oh, darn it, I forgot to bring that ginger ale to that guy in 7 Echo. Like, it happens all the time.
So this story begins with the pilot. Actually, he gets, I guess, his phone. He sees his family being held captive by this Kurdish nationalist who says, you're either going to crash the plane or I'm going to kill your family. But the plot really takes off from there, and there are things that happen in the cockpit and things that happen in the cabin that involve the crew, and then things that happen on the ground involving FBI agents, and it gets pretty intense. There's a moment where the experienced flight attendant among the three, who somehow I picture being your voice, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, tells the rookie who's thinking, oh gosh, this is terrible, what are we going to do? I'll just serve the drinks while you guys do the serious work. And then the experienced one says, no, 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 serving drinks is not our job. This is a real credo of yours, isn't it?
It is, and it's... There's a misconception that flight attendants are on board for service, that we're there just to bring you food and drink, and that's just not true. Flight attendants are on board for safety and security and to be medical first responders, period. Service is just something that we provide. And it's been really, really nice to hear so many people say, I guess I never made that connection. And I always tell them, I'm like, yeah, if flight attendants were on board a plane just to bring you a drink, I promise you they would have replaced us with vending machines a really long time ago. And if you're having a heart attack, I'm not going to bring you a Diet Coke. I'm going to bring the defibrillator and I'm going to shock your heart. And that's really kind of an angle of flight attending that is just not portrayed most of the time. And I'm very proud of the way that flight attendants are portrayed in this book. And it's very satisfying to hear that the response to it is very positive.
Well, I have to say, for those of us who take flights which are routine and uneventful, what we see you doing is, in fact, serving us, you know, which it's never struck me as terribly easy, actually, going up and down these aisles while the plane is bumping and yawing and trying to do the job. What kinds of dangerous situations are you trained for, and how do you practice them?
If all you see us do is a beverage service, that's a great day at work, because that means that we're not actually doing our job, because we have training and everything from hazmat to hijackings to medical situations to turbulence to mechanical issues. I mean, we go through an extensive training program, and then every year we go through a recurrent training program that is multiple days and has online components as well. We have a manual that's, you know, 800 pages long, and we just know it backwards. Self-defense, we have a big unit in self-defense that we're trained with, and then there's also supplementary self-defense training that the TSA and the FAA provides if flight attendants want to attend that. Service is something that is barely even touched on in initial training. It's just not what we do. That's not what we're there for. But like I said, if that's all you see us doing, that's a great day. That means I'm not actually doing my job. I'm just delightfully providing service.
So can you share with us the scariest thing that's happened to you in flight?
One of the scariest things was I had a passenger have a complete psychotic break. And it wasn't enough of a medical emergency or physical threat that we diverted. But what it meant was that we had to handle this passenger who at any moment could turn violent, could turn who knows what, in a pressurized tube with hundreds of people going, you know, hundreds of miles an hour. And I think that it was that sustained tension for hours while we just tried to manage the situation that is that's just one story of so many that are like that. I mean, the margin of error when you're on a plane and you're on a flight is so small. And even something as small as a, you know, someone having a psychotic break, what could be considered small if it goes well, but if it doesn't go well, we're really in a world of hurt.
So what was this passenger saying or doing?
Nonsense, to tell you the truth. There was, she was throwing light things around the cabin. If it escalated to more aggressive violence than we would have diverted, just interacting with strangers, making everyone around her uncomfortable. We're not sure physically if she was okay, if she was going to, there were some physical symptoms that we saw. And you know, so many incidents that happen like that too are, it's like a whodunit case too. You're trying to figure out, what has this person eaten? Have they, you know, are they traveling with anybody on board? Have they consumed alcohol? Have they consumed drugs? What medication are they on? And so you're trying to cobble all of this together for someone who's most likely, and especially in this case, was not being honest with us, while also trying to, you know, maintain safety and control of the cabin, while also trying to serve drinks and food as well. It's a real balancing act.
You know, and I would imagine that in a circumstance like that, in addition to assessing the condition and potential threat of this person, you've got all the people around them, you know, many whom may be a little uneasy about flying anyway. You've got to somehow find some way to reassure them, I assume, with an expression, a gesture.
Exactly. And not only that, we're also trained to think, okay, this is a big scene that's happening right now. I'm giving this all of my attention, but I'm also keeping one eye on the rest of the cabin, because what if this is a diversion? What if this is trying to take our attention away while something else is happening on the aircraft that is actually the nefarious action? Part of our training is mentally getting us into a space where we're always just aware of our surroundings. We're constantly aware of the passengers and the plane and everything around us. Because like I said, the margin of error is very small. And if something goes sideways, we need to be prepared to react quickly.
There's a moment as this crisis in the story intensifies and the crew, I mean, including the flight attendants, are preparing for disaster, that the lead flight attendant, whose name is Joe, she is admiring the way that they had come together, the passengers in the cabin. She said the souls on board had become a family, and the short life of this family was about to end, and as a group they faced their mortality together. Joe was so proud to be with his people, proud to have added her voice to theirs. This is an interesting moment where the flight attendant is really having some kind of very meaningful connection with this random group of people. Did you ever feel that?
I felt that all the time. That's what it is, you know? You're in an enclosed environment with a select group of people, and for the period of that flight, whether it's a quick 45-minute flight or a six-hour, you know, cross-country transcon, it's you guys, and you're all in this together. And especially when you face any sort of situation, it just becomes poignant that you're a little collective group. And I can wax romantic about aviation all day long, but Joe's outlook that she puts there, I mean, I wrote that because that's how I look at the plane. That's how I look at a group of passengers. We are a family, and it's a limited time, but for that limited time, it's us.
You know, you're getting this book contract as a first novel, you know, based on your experiences as a flight attendant, has gotten a fair amount of attention in the publishing press. And I have to say, this reminded me of when Scott Turow wrote his novel, Presumed Innocent, which has been, gosh, more than 20 years now. But I mean, he was a lawyer, and he wrote this book, which had this sort of really kind of grabbed the feel of the sort of randomness and disorganization of the criminal justice system. And I remember him saying in an interview that lawyers around him were saying, gosh, I should have thought of that. Yeah, just write a book about this stuff. And he was saying, well, yeah, it's not quite that simple. And he'd actually spent years, you know, studying creative writing. And it's not just like getting your experiences down on a page. And I assume it was not quite so easy for you. How did you learn how to write a novel?
It definitely was not easy, and it took a lot of work. I mean, a lot of work. I convinced myself to start with very small goals, and the first goal was just finish the story. And like I said, I didn't tell anybody that I was doing this, and part of the reason I didn't tell anybody why I was doing this was because I had already put myself out there by moving to New York after I graduated from college with a degree in musical theater and pursuing my dreams on Broadway and in front of all my friends and family and the whole world, failed miserably. And I had moved home to Phoenix, moved back in with my parents, and I was embarrassed. And by the time I licked my wounds enough and sort of had gotten up enough courage to be able to do something creative again, it was writing. And so I would start to write stories and I would abandon them, if I'm being honest, because my confidence was shaken. I didn't have any confidence in anything that I was putting out artistically. But when I had the idea for this book, it was the first time that, like I was just saying, my need to know what happened to these characters was stronger than my fear of failure and my feelings of inadequacy.
I've read that you wrote this book in part pieces at a time while you were on red-eye flights. Tell us how that worked.
I did, yeah. Red-eyes, I'm naturally a night owl, so red-eyes are my favorite flights to work. And, you know, once the plane got airborne and we did initial service and got everybody kind of tucked into bed, basically, the plane got quiet and I had the forward galley to myself because I worked in first class most of the time. And so I would write. And I would write longhand on the back of the manifest or the back of a catering bill or whatever I had there. And a passenger would come around the corner and ask for something, you know, and I just sort of flip the paper over and tuck it away. And then once they were taken care of, I'd pull it back out and keep going.
It's interesting that your mom and sister were both flight attendants. Did they spend a long time at it?
Yeah, we call it the family business. And yeah, my mom did it her whole adult life, basically. And my sister flew for, I want to say she was at 15 years, I think. And I flew for 10.
So was your mom flying while you were growing up? Was it weird to have her gone so much?
She was, but to me that was normal, so it didn't seem weird to me. I know aviation is a strange industry for people outside of it. It's like, what do you mean she's just gone? But that's how we grew up. That seems normal to us, so it didn't seem weird to us.
There's a way in which it looks, sounds really glamorous. I mean, you're always going to one place or another, and you're staying at presumably nice hotels. On the other hand, you know, it could be a drag to just be going from hotel to airport and these short turnarounds and never in your own bed. Is it both? Would you recommend it?
It's definitely both. It seems far more glamorous than it is. Absolutely seems far more glamorous than it is, but I absolutely would recommend it. It's a phenomenal job where you get to visit great places that you probably wouldn't, you know, otherwise, and stay in nice hotels and fly with the best crews. That's the main thing, is the crews that you fly with and the passengers that you get to meet. That being said, have I spent many days on my hands and knees, you know, scraping up a complete stranger's vomit? Yeah, I definitely have. It's not pretty a lot of the time.
Well, TJ Newman, it's been fun. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been great.
TJ Newman spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Newman spent 10 years as a flight attendant. Her debut novel is called Falling.